The Cyblogs podcast is produced with the help of an AMP Do Your Thing scholarship. Go to doyourthing.co.nz to find out how AMP can help you do your thing.
On the Cyblogs podcast this week, a court case about climate science. We look at attempts by climate skeptics to invalidate the country's climate record. We talk to a climate scientist about what the evidence actually shows for global warming and the PhD bubble. Are we training too many doctoral students? We're talking climate change today. Soon we're going to catch up with James Renwick, one of the country's most experienced climate scientists, about what the latest science is telling us about the state of global climate change. But first, we examine a high court case that's been running this week in Auckland, in which a group of New Zealand climate skeptics are seeking a judicial review of the country's climate records, constructed and maintained by the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. The skeptics claim the methodology used to construct the climate record is flawed and has led to NIWA overstating the rate of warming identified in New Zealand over the last 100 years or so. It's a case that seems to be without precedent in New Zealand, but does it have any merit? And is it all just a waste of time and money, given that the major international sources of climate data show a warming trend anyway? Cyblogger and Hot Topic founder Gareth Renowden joins me now to discuss the case.
So Gareth, this is really the culmination of sort of a sustained campaign, I guess you could call it, against NIWA. It started a couple of years ago. There were lots of questions in the House, questions of the science minister of the time, Dr. Wayne Mapp. And really it's the New Zealand Climate Science Educational Trust that is challenging the national temperature record. Who are these guys?
Well, they're basically the New Zealand Climate Science Coalition by another name. My understanding is that they formed the Education Trust in order to have an organisation that could bring the case, because otherwise they were just a sort of loose association of New Zealand sceptics. There is possibly another reason, and that is that it's possible that if they lose the case, the trust would give them some protection against an order for costs, for instance.
Right, so this is a trust that's been set up by the Climate Science Coalition, and this is a quite vocal, small group of some of them ex-scientists, not climate scientists, but you have, for instance, the likes of Brian Leyland, who's an engineer. You have Terry Dunleavy, who has had sort of dabbled in politics over the last few decades. So you have this loose collection of scientists. They're very active on the international stage in climate skeptic circles as well.
Yes, they kind of punch above their weight. If I don't want to give them too much credit, but they do get noticed on the world stage. They have been funded in the past by the American far-right libertarian Heartland Institute. So money from America has been coming in to support their organisation. They're probably, you would describe them as friends of the ACT Party. They're on the sort of right wing, it would seem to me, looking at what they say and what they do. And they are all convinced that climate change or action against climate change is unnecessary. And they've been campaigning that way for many years. I think the coalition itself was formed in the mid-2000s, possibly 2005, 2006. But they this court case is something that grew out of basically an attempt to show that there was no warming in New Zealand. They basically took the published temperature records, which are, if you like, the raw data that's been recorded around the country over the last 150 years, and said, hey, look, there's been no warming. But what they were doing was ignoring the corrections that have to be made to build a long-term temperature record. Now, since then, their case has morphed into being, well, yeah, okay, we'll admit you need to correct the temperature record, but hey, you're not doing it properly. They were able then to kind of spin this through questions in Parliament and everything else into some sort of data scandal. You know, they made a great play about it being similar to the so-called Climategate allegations at the University of East Anglia, when, you know, they were accused of hiding data or hiding decline and everything else. So it was New Zealand's little attempt, if you like, to build off the back of that wider Climategate thing. And at the same time, the chairmanship of the coalition changed and became a lawyer, Barry Brill, who is a recently retired lawyer, former National Party government minister under Rob Muldoon, and an ACT Party candidate at the last election, if I'm correct. So I think, you know, a retired lawyer, what does he do? He goes to law.
And they're really honing in on this so-called seven-station series and some of the adjustments that were made to that data. Take us through what the seven-station series is.
Okay, well, it's seven locations around the country that have been chosen to represent the temperatures of New Zealand. Now, it's a fairly arbitrary choice which places you choose, but you obviously go for the places where people live. So you've got Dunedin, you've got Hokitika, you've got Christchurch, you've got Wellington, you've got Auckland, and a couple of others that escape me for the moment. But the idea is that if you take a long-term record across those sites, scattered around the country, and then put them all together, you end up with something that can be called a record of how New Zealand's temperatures have changed over the last 150 years when recordings first started. Now, to do that, because at each individual city, the sort of station of record will have changed site over the years. The method of recording the temperatures will have changed. They would have been mercury thermometers in the early days. They're most likely to be automatic weather stations now using thermocouples. And what that means is that there's discontinuities in the data. And so you have to correct for those discontinuities in order to be able to compare the data that you've got from the 1860s, say, with the data that you've got from the 1960s and today. And it's what the Climate Science Education Trust are complaining about, it seems to me, is how these have been done. So what they want is the court to declare that New Zealand's temperature record, as calculated by NIWA, now they've done it twice, in fact, should be declared invalid. And quite what that means, I don't know. They seem to want government not to rely on NIWA's advice on New Zealand's temperature record. And they claim that New Zealand's policies on climate change have somehow depended on the extent of warming in New Zealand. But of course, you know, New Zealand's actions on climate change, the legislation and the policies that have been put in place actually don't depend on what temperatures are in New Zealand, because it's a global issue. So New Zealand's been involved from the early days of the Kyoto Protocol precisely because New Zealand is actually quite a good international player in these regards, and so goes with the international flow, as it were.
Of course, we've got the UN's IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that really informs most of, when you read the government literature, most of their discussions on climate change, backed up by NIWA, but definitely it seems to be a small part of the puzzle, New Zealand's temperature records. The records do show a national warming trend of almost 1 degree Celsius in the last century, which is a bit above the global average, am I right?
Yeah, it's very slightly above the global average. The thing about New Zealand's temperature is that it's actually very variable. It goes up and it goes down quite a lot because of cycles in the ocean. So you get patches of cold water come past New Zealand and we get cold years. You get patches of warm water come past and we get warm years. So there's actually quite a lot of variability in our national record. But the biggest sign that we've had substantial warming is actually to look at the amount of ice that there is in the Alps. And there was an interesting article, actually.
I saw that in the Sunday Star Times, I think, over the weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, it might have been the Sunday Star Times. Are frozen assets slowly melting away? And you're talking about, you know, really substantial chunks of ice disappearing. Probably only 400 of them have been named, and quite a few of the small ones have disappeared since, you know, records really started being taken in detail in the last 30 years. So the Tasman Glacier, for instance, is 150 metres thinner than since it's first surveyed in 1891. So, you know, something is making these glaciers go away. If it's not temperature, it could be drought. But I don't think there's been any sign of a drought up at the main divide on the South Island.
From what you know, Gareth, the adjustments that have been made to the seven-station series, how do they compare to best practice internationally on this type of thing?
Well, the original seven-station series was prepared by Jim Salinger in the Met Service days, back in the early 1990s, and used a technique that Jim developed with another guy called Rhodes. And that formed the basis for the Seven Station series right up until the Climate Science Coalition started making a fuss. NIWA then sat down and recalculated the Seven Station series using the latest and best techniques that they could find. And they went through it in considerable detail and spent a lot of time and a lot of money reconstructing the series and discovered that although there were some detailed differences between the reconstruction and that they had done, that it was the overall picture remained almost identical to the original Rhodes and Salinger one. So in effect, we've had a double checking of the process and discovered that, well, it hasn't made much difference. That doesn't help us with the sceptics, however, because this is such a complicated issue. When you get down to the nitty-gritty of moving, from one site in Hokitika to another, and how much should you reduce temperatures by or increase them by to create a homogenised record, it's incredibly detailed. And to be honest, my view is it's fundamentally irrelevant because New Zealand has warmed. We can see that by the ice having gone. And New Zealand will or will not take action on climate change, depending on international diplomacy and the real politic of international relations. So this is really just political grandstanding. It's a means for them to get coverage in the press, to make a bit of a fuss, and to kind of justify their profile as sceptics.
Have you heard of this happening anywhere else, a judicial review seeking to overturn climate change records?
No, I haven't. I know that Barry Brill would love to export the New Zealand approach overseas. I think there have been some rumblings in Australia that they'd like to do something like that, but nobody's actually got it together. There certainly has been a lot of freedom of information requests from sceptics trying to get at what they call the raw data. The irony, of course, is that when they get the raw data, they don't actually do anything with it. The scientific process would be to take the data, construct your own, in the case of New Zealand, temperature series, and get it published in the peer-reviewed literature and let other scientists look at what you've done and criticise it and work out. But all we've had from the Climate Science Coalition is a bunch of papers that they've published on their own websites. They're not being subjected to peer review. They're not part of the scientific literature.
Okay, so the evidence that they're presenting in court hasn't been peer reviewed. They're not calling scientific experts.
As far as I know, they have got at least one deposition from an external scientist who's a guy called Bob Carter, who's a very high profile sceptical scientist, actually a New Zealander, but based in Queensland. And Carter is, how shall I put this? politely and in a way that doesn't get you sued. He's renowned for his counterfactual position on climate change.
So it seems staggering, the concept that our national temperature record could be invalidated through court action like this. Do you think that is a realistic possibility?
Oh, look, it's almost impossible to second guess what a judge is going to do. You know, sometimes these things come down to the legal argument, and there may well be, maybe there is something in the law or the way that they framed their statement of claim that enables them to do something that that might enable them to claim a victory. It isn't going to change anything, even if they do win. I mean, I think the ideal result would be for the judge to listen to all the evidence and turn around and say, OK, well, there's nothing to answer here. You guys are, basically wrong. But that would be the right result in my view, but I very much doubt that it's going to be as straightforward as that. The law is never terribly clear unless you're a lawyer, and even then probably not, because they like to charge you a lot of money for your advice, don't they?
That was science writer and blogger Gareth Renowden. Check out his blog hot-topic.co.nz. Associate Professor James Renwick has just joined the School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences at Victoria University. But for years, he contributed to climate research in his previous capacity at the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, NIWA. Recently, Renwick gave a lecture at Victoria on climate science. You'll find a link to the audio of his lecture in the show notes at cyblogs.co.nz. Dacia Herbalock also spoke to him for the Cyblogs podcast.
We're running this amazing geophysical experiment, putting a lot of greenhouse gas, heat-trapping gas into the atmosphere, and we're watching what happens. And from a scientific point of view, it's really fascinating. From my point of view, I'm lucky to be living now because I get to see this amazing change happening in the world, in the climate system. But at the same time, I feel really uneasy because we change the climate, we change where it rains, we change the temperature extremes, and we put an awful lot of people at risk. So it's a very dangerous experiment that we're running at the moment.
Yeah, you've had a lot of different trends that you put up. I mean, it was basically across the board.
That's right. The oceans are warming up and the oceans are absorbing the vast majority of the heat that is being put into the climate system. So over 80% of the extra heat in the climate system now is absorbed in the oceans. So we can see that warming right down as far as we can measure, essentially.
And that seems to be a really crucial piece that most people don't really, I think, appreciate the full impact of.
Just no.
how much energy the oceans are able to take up.
That's
and what
right.
that means in terms of the future delayed reaction, as it were.
Yeah. What we worry about is the temperature increasing, you know, is the atmosphere getting warmer? And it is. But there's so much going on with the weather that the temperatures go up and down all the time. And it's hard to see the background trend in the atmosphere. You've got to average right around the globe and average over a decade or two before you can see a signal. In the ocean, you know, the oceans vary much more slowly and it takes a lot more heat to warm them up. So the temperature change is smaller, but it's much steadier. And it's the same idea with glaciers and big ice sheets. It takes a lot of energy to melt them, but putting that energy in, it all gets smoothed out. So if you look at the length of a glacier or the amount of ice in an ice sheet, you know, over time, the trend in that is pretty smooth and the trend is definitely downwards. So of the extra heat that's going into the climate system from the increase in greenhouse gases, like I was saying, over 80% goes into the ocean, but we don't see most of that because it's the deep ocean where the warming's happening, by and large. And it's only a few percent of the heat that goes into melting the glaciers and warming the atmosphere. So the things that we see that get us excited, it's just a small part of the story. And that's something that we really need to be concerned about, because you change the ocean, you put that much heat into the ocean, it takes hundreds or thousands of years for the oceans to adjust to that. So we know that we're in for sea level rise that's going to go on for at least 1,000 years or so, right from today, even if all the greenhouse gas emissions stopped. So we've locked in a lot of change already and a lot of things that just aren't visible to us.
You had a little bit of a focus at the end of your talk where you looked at what's been happening in terms of, you know, global efforts to come to some decision on action to take. And I noted that you said pretty much flat out, we've wasted the past 20 years. You're looking at Rio and what's been happening recently. And I wonder, in terms of the broader feeling amongst climate scientists, do you think that many of your peers are coming more to a sense of frustration and a sense of demoralization as observers for that part of the process?
Certainly a feeling of frustration and a real sense of urgency. I don't know about demoralization. The longer time goes on, the more motivated, I suppose you would say, most climate scientists I know feel about getting that message out there. But that's absolutely right. We have wasted the last 20 years. I remember the Rio summit in 1992, and well, that was a kind of fraught experience in itself, but it led on to the Kyoto Protocol and so on. And these were steps in the right direction, but the reality is that global greenhouse gas emissions have gone up substantially since Rio 92, and nobody has met their Kyoto Protocol commitments, well, apart from, you know, convenient things like the economy and Russia collapsing, so that reduced their emissions a lot. You know, there's been some places where this has happened, but generally, and New Zealand's no exception, emissions have just gone up steadily. So while there's been a lot of talk at a political level about stabilising emissions and limiting warming to 2 degrees, there hasn't actually been any action. So that tells me that nobody's really taking the problem seriously.
And 2 degrees, we've pretty much, we're saying that we've blown through that. 4 degrees, more likely, possibly heading for higher?
Some of the analysis I've seen lately suggests that for this century, 4 degrees is more likely than 2 degrees. It's an incredibly hard problem to solve. greenhouse gases come from burning fossil fuels, the extra ones mostly, and that's at the heart of Western society and economy. And, you know, I'm a part of that as much as anybody else. I drive a car and so on. That's the world that we all live in. But we really do have to do something about it if we're going to avoid major, major changes in the climate system. So one way to look at it is to think this is an incredible business opportunity. It's like the Industrial Revolution. We need whole new ways of powering our devices and our lifestyle. And the people who come up with the ideas to make that happen are going to be the success stories of the future. New Zealand could be the world leader in green technology. But drilling for oil offshore and digging up lignite in Southland is not the way to go. It would be wonderful if New Zealand as a country, that's the business sector and the government, put more money into investing in developing, say, more efficient solar panels or better wind turbines, any kind of renewable, non-greenhouse gas generating energy source would be just fantastic.
Mm. In terms of what you think the role of climate scientists is at this point, I mean, you guys have been through the ringer with everything that happened for Copenhagen, ClimateGate, all of the rigmarole around all the IPCC reports. And I just wonder what, you know, where have you and your peers come to at this point in terms of thinking about public engagement and the media, and what do you think you should be doing in terms of outreach at this stage?
I've always maintained that scientists should publicise their science. If you're not communicating science, then what's the point of doing it? And something like climate change is more than just academically interesting. It's important for the future of society. So it's not enough to just publish a paper in a journal. A scientist who's working in this area, I think, has a duty to make their findings, bring them before policymakers, make them known to the public and so on, so that people can form some kind of considered opinion about what it all means and what we're going to do about it. I haven't changed my views about that kind of outreach over the last few years. I know that there are some people who have been really attacked and, you know, death threats and the whole, all of that kind of thing have happened to some scientists I know. And sure, that's had a devastating effect on them personally. And, you know, that's a really terrible thing. But I'm not aware of anybody who's decided to completely pull back or pull out. I think it gives everyone more of a sense of purpose that it indicates that it's a really contentious issue and there's a lot at stake here, that's for sure. In my opinion, it's given impetus to people who want to publicise the science. I think the idea that there are these attacks going on has just galvanised a lot of the community to keep going.
I mean, I've always wondered with the tuition bubble, you know, it's almost like the housing bubble where credit sort of has flooded the market. You have captive buyers, parents who have to send their kids to college. The government is going to make more money available. So prices keep going up.
Well, I think what's going on is that it's not just a bubble in terms of credit. There's huge rewards in the job market for getting a college degree. There's a reason people want to go to college. Mm-hmm. You make more money, a lot more money, and you're a lot less likely to be unemployed. So the question is, can colleges keep raising tuition? What will colleges, particularly the big state universities, do as states cut appropriations? Is there anything they can do to cut costs before we end up with some kind of revolt or crisis or price themselves out of the market?
That was Wall Street Journal writer David Wessel, interviewed on the paper's video channel about the state of higher education in the United States, where some fear an oversupply of highly educated graduates with limited job prospects and laden with debt from years of university study is creating a dangerous bubble that could have major economic and social implications. But the issue isn't just restricted to the US, which has some of the highest ranked universities in the world and where ambitious young students pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to attend Ivy League colleges. Dr. Melanie Massaro says an oversupply of PhD graduates is eroding the quality of teaching in New Zealand and setting unrealistic expectations for graduates embarking on their careers. The University of Canterbury researcher studies evolutionary changes in New Zealand birds since the introduction of predatory mammals. She has just co-authored a paper in New Zealand Science Review in which she claims that financial incentives drive universities to encourage more students to enroll in doctoral programs, even though there is already an oversupply of them. The number of doctoral students in New Zealand has almost doubled from 4,263 in 2003 to 7,916 back in 2010. But the number of academic staff has not increased accordingly. Exacerbating the problem, says Massaro, is the limited opportunity for postdoctoral research in New Zealand, leading to what she calls New Zealand's postdoctoral void. Unable to find work or funding to continue their research, many scientists have no option but to go overseas.
It has been recently noted by a variety of journals. For example, Nature had ran a whole bunch of publications on creating this oversupply on PhD students for whom at the completion of their doctoral degree they have great difficulty finding jobs. So it is a worldwide trend everywhere, but I think here in New Zealand, what is different to the New Zealand situation is that in New Zealand we always had very limited opportunities for postdoctoral researchers. The opportunities for postdocs have gone even further down. We actually highlight that in our paper with a table that we actually got from the Ministry of Science and Innovation. Like in 2006 and 2007, in New Zealand we had around 384 postdocs, so that includes both dependent and independent postdocs. And then in 2009 and 10 we had 323 postdocs. And keep in mind that this year is actually the last year that these FIST postdocs have their funding for another year, and so next year that number is going to drop even further.
So what are these financial incentives driving the amazing New Zealand PhD machine?
So the universities receive, of course, the tuition that comes from the student, but of course that's not a lot of money. But then on top of it, the university gets a component which they get while the student is actually enrolled in the doctoral program, which varies between $8,000 and $26,000. $1,000, that depends on universities, but it also depends on the degree that the PhD student is doing, or in what sort of subject matter they are researching. And then on top of it, the universities also receive those $45,000 once the student has completed its degree. So it's a considerable amount of money for universities to have postgraduate students enrolled and then completing after 3 years or 3 to 3.5 years. So that's the reason what's driving really those financial incentives are really driving this amazing New Zealand PhD machine.
One of the solutions to the problem, says Massaro, is to focus on quality over quantity in higher education. Produce quality PhDs that are highly competitive for the limited job opportunities and assist them better in the transition from academia to non-academic career paths such as private enterprise.
I think we are actually shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit. Universities are more and more focused on getting more students through the system rather than giving the PhD student some quality education. And that actually has been recognized to be a problem overseas as well. And some countries, for example, the US, the UK, and also Canada, have put programs in place where they actually try to address this issue. So they're actually now offering, for example, in the UK, they're offering these, they have these doctoral centers where PhD or students can do their PhD, but they're really trying to offer a quality program which is 4 years rather than 3 years, and the students really get trained in, you know, a multitude of avenues or interdisciplinary research, and that really helps them because then they have a unique set of skills that then allows them more likely to get to find full-time employment after the PhD. And I think New Zealand really needs to rethink very carefully on how we are funding our universities and what model should be used, because that is ultimately driving on how we can, A, give our students a quality education and then also ensure that our students are able to get jobs after they completed their PhDs here at New Zealand universities.
The Advanced Technology Institute, details of which were announced last week, will seek to stimulate research and development efforts in the private sector, something that could open up opportunities for emerging researchers going into industry. But Massaro says we risk focusing too much on applied science.
I'm a bit afraid at the moment the government is spending, you know, there's a lot of effort on business and industry-related research, but we have to acknowledge that other research avenues are just as important for a healthy society, and that is, for example, environmental sciences or even health sciences, as well as health sciences, to recognize that in order to have a society or make sure that New Zealand is still a place where you want to live in, you know, the next 50 years, is really that we do have to do some environmental science to keep track of climate change, for example. And these things are important as well. And I mean, I applaud, MSI, or they don't exist anymore. Now, I don't know what this new department is called. I applaud them for doing these, creating these links between industry and science. I think that is a step in the right direction. It is also important that the government recognizes that other sciences, for example, environmental sciences or health sciences, public health sciences, are just as important, and we also need to make sure that these sciences are supported.
Massaro, for her part, has a pretty tenuous existence at the moment. She's on a fixed research contract that is only a year long. She's appealing to university leaders to give more certainty to postdocs like herself and re-examine opportunities for PhDs to create more sustainable higher education in New Zealand.
I don't have full-time employment at the moment, so I'm also on one of those fixed-term contracts, which are on a yearly basis and not very much money. So, I mean, I'm currently searching for a permanent academic position, so I'm not entirely sure where I'm going to go. I'm very passionate about my research, so I would like to continue the work that I'm doing. I'm not sure on how much more I'm going to invest into this postdoctoral issue. I mean, it is really an issue. You know, I can highlight these things by writing this paper, and I can, you know, highlight this issue by going to this conference and giving a talk. But it's really up to, you know, the people who are in the government, in the ministry, and also the people who are in the tops of universities. It is time that these people finally sit together and come up with a system that actually is going to benefit New Zealand. Before you take on a PhD student, I think it's almost a moral issue to let these PhD students know, okay, this is what you're getting yourself into. Okay, if you know all the facts beforehand and you are still interested in continuing your degree and completing a doctoral program, then this is, of course, up to the student. I mean, it is ultimately their decision whether they want to do a PhD, whether they want to go down this route. But I think what is important here is that we let our PhD students know exactly what their prospects are, their job prospects are. And this is, I think, the one where the universities are really lacking. And I can understand why, of course. I mean, for the universities, it's a matter of we make money by having doctoral PhD students in the programs, of course. However, the problem is it's not fair towards those PhD students, those enrolling PhD students, because they don't know all the facts.
Melanie Massaro there. Check out the show notes for links to the paper and other articles mentioned. And that's our show. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes on Stitcher.com or stream it directly from cyblogs.co.nz. Follow us on Twitter at cyblogsnz or on Facebook, facebook.com. Thanks for tuning in. Come back next Friday for more science news and views with a Kiwi spin here on the Cyblogs podcast.